Hello, fellow lunchers. I'm thrilled that you found your way to us here at Out to Lunch, the ultimate destination for fascinating chat over great food. My guest today is known for travelling across the globe, visiting challenging places, meeting interesting people, and getting deep into dangerous situations. He started researching his New York Times best-selling book, The New Jackals, when he was just 21. Once published, a few years later, it became the first mainstream book on bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, and a new age of terrorism, and in the wake of 9/11 made him the man everyone needed to speak to. He's fronted well over 25 globe-trotting TV series, including Equator, Indian Ocean, and Pilgrimage. Today, we chat about hunting down South African neo-Nazi terrorists, learning to really listen to people, and being an adrenaline junkie. It is, of course, author, journalist, and broadcaster Simon Reeve.
The best example of that was going in to see the boss of BBC Two with nothing but a single page printed out of a map from Wikipedia, holding up and saying, Indian Ocean. My goodness. And she went, oh, and that was it.
So for this episode of Out to Lunch, I have come to a development on London's South Bank, just by Tower Bridge. You can hear the fountains in the background. The current home of the Greater London Authority is here, although they're about to move. And behind me is the restaurant I'm taking Simon Reeve to. Now, he was due, as lockdown one began, to be filming a series in South America. And that didn't happen for obvious reasons, because we were locked down. So I thought it would be nice if I brought him to an outpost of the small group Gaucho, the Argentinian steakhouse chain. See where I'm going? He was meant to be in Argentina. He isn't. So I brought him to a little bit of Argentina on London's South Bank by Tower Bridge. And the fountains are here celebrating my choice. Oh, it's all coming together. Let's get inside. This is Chris.
Hello, Chris. Simon, nice to see you.
Well, I just want to say welcome to Gaucho.
Thank you.
From a newspaper man's point of view, which is what I really am, I am intrigued by one part of your story which always gets glossed over.
Right.
Which is, how did you go from the post room at the Sunday Times to being a researcher and then an investigator and journalist? And what was Andrew Neil's role in that?
I would have been 17. I was fresh out of school, having flunked out of my exams. I'd been on the dole, I'd been on the edge of a bridge. I was right down
by,
there.
By on the edge of a bridge, you mean thinking of jumping off it?
Not just thinking, but on the wrong side of the rails. I didn't really have any ambitions. I got a job as a postboy eventually.
How did that happen? I mean, did it come at the local job centre? Did it?
I spent a lot of time in those flipping job centres, wandering around, but no, it didn't. I mean, it's a ridiculous story because it came through my dad spotting an advert in an old copy of the Sunday Times. I have a proper ad saying, apply for the postroom here. So it was specifically non-graduates who Andrew Neil specifically wanted to enter the postroom.
That's extraordinary, actually.
Yeah. And, you know, I had a big break where, John Witherow,
yeah.
He actually came up to me one day when I was sorting the post and said, I need you to go on a mission. I was like, okay. I need you to go to Boston to find two South African neo-Nazi terrorists who are on the run. What? I'm properly really calm. That okay, paling inside, faffing, and I was just yes, okay. As I went off to talk to people I knew there, I was like, he wants me to go to Boston, for goodness sake. I've never been on a plane. And I'll go and say, I haven't got a passport, what am I going to do? And I went running around like this, like this sort of headless chicken, telling everybody and anyone. And then Peter, the chief investigative guy, said, calm down, Simon, it's Boston in Lincolnshire.
Okay.
But still, two South African neo-Nazi terrorists. They didn't expect me to find them. They didn't expect them to answer the phone to me and let me, you know, that they would meet up
and
with me.
And you did find them.
And I did. It wasn't hard. They'd given, we had some numbers where they might be, and people were trying each number, and they were sending dog's bodies like me, gophers, to actually
knock on doors
to see if they would answer. Oh, it's bizarre. These two guys on the platform and little Boston in Lincolnshire, carrying a bag of documents and a bag of weapons and documents that showed they'd been funded by the South African Security Service. Thank you very much. Destabilising the peace process. Big stuff. Anyway, I did that, and after that, you're sort of away.
Sort of unfairly, perhaps, the reason I chose Gaucho was you were literally meant to be wandering all over South America, and I thought it might be either amusing or just rubbing your face in it to take you to an Argentinian restaurant.
I did have one of my most memorable ever meals with some gauchos in Argentina.
Now, there's a menu to your left.
Yes.
I don't know what you fancy. It's an Argentinian restaurant. They have steaks.
A scallop's acceptable to order.
Scallops are fine. They're diver. They're not dredged.
I might have the scallops.
All right. Diver scallops. And I will... actually, I'll have the shrimp ceviche.
Any choice?
And then you want a ribeye?
Chorizo sirloin. A strip of juicy crackling quite appeals to me. I'll have the chorizo sirloin, please. Something in the middle. 400 grams.
And I'll have a ribeye. And can I get some king oyster mushrooms as a side? Can we share those?
Yeah.
And chips?
What does the steak come with, Usher? Oh, look, it's... Cows enjoying a lush-free lifestyle. Lush-free-range lifestyle, sorry.
Like you, as you do, Simon. Can I get some of the chimichurri on the side?
Of course.
Do you want a sauce?
No, I won't, actually. Cool. I think I've got the chorizo and the juicy crackling.
You'll be fine.
Yeah, I'll have the spinach, actually. Please.
Yep, thank you. May I just ask if you are happy with the medium rare?
I am.
Temperature for the steaks?
Yes, please, thank you.
Brilliant, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Right, the complicated bit is done.
Hello.
Shrimp ceviche with jalapeno and avocado.
Thank you.
Thank you. Oh my God, that's good, thank you.
You've got scallops with breadcrumbs and is there a little, I think, romesco sauce under there?
I think there's some romesco sauce.
Is there some romesco sauce?
Yeah.
Obviously, some of what you do is dangerous or transpires, becomes dangerous. Just for anybody who's not necessarily across your entire earth. Not pushing it too far, still includes interviewing commanders of FARC and asking them how many people they've killed. Going into the most dangerous prison in the world with a bishop for protection, because God knows they're handy with their fists. the famous landmine field on the border with Mauritania.
Yes, all right, well now you say it.
Yeah. I'm just...
But honestly,
you obviously, because you're here having lunch with me, you've survived all of these.
Yeah, and it could have gone horribly wrong sometimes, but so can walking out in the street or joking on a chip. I'm not being too flippant, I hope.
You are slightly.
Life is risky. You know, you and I, we'll have experienced death in our lives. We'll have known people who've died tragically too early. We cannot live on our knees, and we have to mitigate risk wherever possible, sensibly, but we still have to live in existence. But okay, no, I'm not... Yes, we've driven through a minefield. Yes, we've got lost in a minefield. That wasn't what we expected to do. We had to deal with the situation as we found it. We did knowingly go into a inmate-controlled prison in Honduras, which was very dangerous, but we knew we had, or we felt we knew that the gangs had a solid chance of talking to us and wanting us to be there. We did go in with somebody who we felt they trusted. We made a considered judgment about the bishop's likelihood of protecting us, his ability to, and their, you know, these things were considered. It wasn't done daftly.
When these things were happening, do you get scared?
Not that much anymore. And I don't think really very much when I'm in a situation like that. I'm thinking about too many other things. I'm thinking about where the camera is, are they okay? What the hell are we doing? Where are we going? What on earth is he saying? Trying to understand. Is anyone looking sketchy? Are they getting nervy themselves? You know, I'm processing almost too much. My brain hasn't got the space for the nerves in that moment. But I do also think because I'm middle-aged and I've been doing this a long time, I've worked that muscle, if you like, and it's I've got better at dealing with it and dealing with it. But I still want to feel affected by it. There have been times when I've thought, looking back, I should have been more worried about this. I write in the book about a moment, for example, where we were in Honduras before we went into the prison, I think, and we were out in the gang areas where there are murders. The suffering there is terrible, and we'd had a call saying there'd been two policemen, or there'd been a shooting. They thought a couple of policemen might have been involved. Maybe they'd been killed, and we tailgated a police car or an ambulance through heavy traffic to try and get to the scene of this.
You've been invited
murder.
To do so, or were you just?
I don't know. I think we were just. It wasn't quite. We were just going.
Right.
And we got slightly separated from the car in front. We got boxed in. We were stuck on this road. It was a gridlock. And then somebody said, almost jokingly, do you want us to cross the central reservation and drive the wrong way down the motorway? And I'm like, yeah, great. And I turned to my colleague in the back, and he was like, okay. And so we said, yeah. And the guy was a bit surprised, but they went for it. And we crossed the central reservation, then we drove down the wrong way down the motorway. And we were sort of weaving a bit, and it was far from ideal, and I'm sure a breach of conventional health and safety, but we weren't bothered at all. And I remember thinking about it afterwards and realizing that colleague in the back had just been texting and I'd just been eating a flapjack. And then I thought, okay,
that's the problem, isn't
it?
Because
as
you do riskier and riskier things, you become inured to the basically risky.
But I think we're pretty good at it. I really genuinely do. I think we're pretty good at gauging the risk and mitigating it. And you were saying about people said no. Okay, so traveling around the Mediterranean, we wanted to go and film in the Sinai. And we were told, we just cannot find anyone that you can ally yourself with, any militant group that would keep you alive, or the army there, where there's just no one. It's just the most dangerous place in the world to try and film there. It cannot be done. And we tried and tried and we just couldn't. So there I was told no, effectively, but it wasn't somewhere where I was saying suicidally, we're going. I've got to accept the facts. The people I work with have got families, you know, we want to come home.
Which brings me to the other point. The people you work with have got families, and so do you.
Yeah.
You talk very movingly about meeting Anya, your wife, who's also a camerawoman, traveller, many things.
Mm.
And early on, you travel together and work together. You now have a son together, Jake. But one of the most, and just sort of for some background, I was asked by editors at various times to go to Rwanda, I was asked to go to Iraqi Kurdistan long before I became food critic. And the reason I didn't was because I couldn't countenance just how terrified my partner, wife, would be of not knowing I was safe.
Mm.
Do you ever think about that? About Anya at home not knowing how you are?
That's very interesting. I do. We're all different, and how we process our fears and concerns is all very different. I think my wife, Anya, should speak for herself on it. Far be it from me, but what she said is she knows we're pretty careful. She knows what I do, why I do it. She's worked on the programs. She's cool and calm and appropriately collected.
You can be away for weeks at a time.
Yeah. I think the area where it's been difficult has been with my son.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because, I don't think I'm in any way trespassing on something private here, because the book is dedicated to Jake.
No, it's fine.
And top and bottom, you talk about wanting him to have a sense of adventure.
Mm.
Someone being very critical could say, and yet, on a regular basis, you abandon him.
Mm.
You leave. You're just not there.
I don't think abandon would be fair. No, I think they have to be pretty hypercritical for the abandon. I don't think that's warranted.
Okay.
No, abandon, I think, suggests without care. And that's just not the case. I mean, he's been left with somebody who dotes and cares for him much better than I ever could, and very tangibly, with grandparents as well and other loved ones and friends and family around. But yes, I go away. That is my job. I am not a squaddy going off and doing a six-month tour. I'm a teleponce who goes away for a few weeks and comes back. And my entire working existence is scheduled around my son's life and his holidays, which are marked out in bloody blue fluorescent pen so I can be there for him. But yes, I've missed parts of his life, and that's because I've been away earning and working and being a relatively fulfilled... I don't know.
It sounds to me like you do. It's not that I've asked the question. It's something you struggle with.
No, I haven't struggled with it, in truth. I haven't thought about it enough, but the whole lockdown process of where, you know, I'm slightly twiddling thumbs, trying to do home parenting and being a bit rubbish at it, but also thinking about what I'm going to do. And you know, my son was a bit interested in the journeys during lockdown, so I started talking about some of the journeys, boring him again with Tales from the Congo and so on. And then it did give me a chance to think back about the adventures and experiences and map out what I'd done and realise, my goodness, yeah, I left him as a baby and went to Mogadishu. You know, that's not good at all. But that's my job. It wasn't done on a whim. It wasn't done to promote an album or something. It was to genuinely
try and learn. Is the point that it was your job before he arrived?
Before he arrived, during... It's how both my wife and I, we earn our living, and, you know, she's intimately involved at every stage. So I think in terms of how she feels about it, I think she knows as much as I do about what's going on and how we do it, and has been on the other side of the camera and still helps plan and is involved in the logistics. So she's up on that. I think, you know, in terms of the criticism, I think it's much more fair to say, what the hell are you doing leaving your lad? I've got one son. He hasn't got lots of siblings to turn to as well. And I worry about it, I do. And there's a, you know, I wanted to be candid about that in the book. And I've put in one of the most intimate personal things I could, which is a letter I wrote him at a moment when I was very emotional and a bit drunk and had some really spiritual encounters. And I wrote him a letter because I was worried that I wasn't going to be around for him. And yes, something could have happened in those years that meant I might not be, or I might have been horrifically injured. Yes, it's possible. Do I think the job justifies it? I do. I still really do. And I feel more confident saying that, even though, you know, I'm a cringingly self-apologizing character, you know. But I think it's really bloody important that we get out there and we show people what's going on in the world. That's a massively important thing. Whether I'm the best person for it, well, that's a whole other matter. But, yeah.
You've got the gig.
I've got the gig, yeah. Yeah, and people watch. I can't believe they do, and I'm incredibly grateful for it.
Where else do you want to go? What are the things?
I want to go back to South America and finish filming, continue filming there.
Is that still scheduled to happen?
Yeah, we're hoping to. It really matters what's going on there, and we've already done some filming, which was brilliant, and we had some incredible stories there, and I really want that to be out on the telly. I'd love to go to Japan, West Africa.
You've never done West Africa?
I've travelled a lot in Africa, but not so much in West Africa, and I'd love to go to Senegal and Mali. But one of the challenges for me, as shallow as it is, just to, you know, it's not an insight into the media, but maybe it is as well. You know, I've got to come up with a journey that can be encapsulated in a small, you know, you can get it from a really short, sexy, evocative title. The title has to have that elusive promise of pleasure. Now, the best example of that was going in to see the boss of BBC Two with nothing but a single page printed out of a map from Wikipedia and holding up and saying, Indian Ocean, showing a map of the Indian Ocean. That was it. Indian Ocean, my goodness. And she went, oh. And that was it. Six-part series commissioned.
On the basis of a page of Wikipedia?
On the
and you're going, oh, Indian Ocean.
Yes, yes.
How did the first of your travel shows happen?
I was still very late 20s. I'd written a book. I was an author.
Who contacted you?
God, I can't.
Was it the BBC or was it a TV production?
There were a
company?
Few different approaches around the same time, because I'd been doing the sort of pundit in the studio sort of chats about what on earth was going on in the world. And so then I started talking with broadcasters. Some had some really daft ideas. One was an American company that wanted me to infiltrate Al-Qaeda for a TV series. And, you know, I mean, I listened, right? But they had...
Made in Kandahar.
Whoa, they were right. They had no idea. I was terrifying to meet people who had so much dosh. that they could do things with, and so little idea about what that might involve.
One of the things that's very striking about you is your use of silence, of not peppering questions. Is that a fair description of it?
Yes.
I'll just have a sip of wine and you talk.
I think Peter Hounam at the Sunday Times, he said to me, you know, you just if you just stop talking, people will fill that gap, that gaping hole. They'll tell you things that you really want to hear. It's not to outrageously elicit what somebody doesn't want to say. It's just to sort of create a bit of space to make it possible, I think, I would like to claim. But yeah, sometimes I'll just keep smiling at them and they'll keep chatting. Drives the guys I'm with a bit bonkers sometimes. They're holding 14 kilos on their shoulder and trying to keep it in focus, and I'm just sitting there smiling and somebody's chatting away. We want to know what's going on. We don't always get it right, definitely. I mean, there's times when I feel like, ooh, we've missed the mark there. You know, we've got to try and sum up a situation or a story, and we do our best with it. We really do. Sometimes with a bit of silence.
I can see how long I could just not interrupt you with questions.
You didn't last long, did you?
No, it didn't. Where have you got it wrong?
Doesn't work on a podcast.
Where have you got it wrong?
Oh, goodness. Ireland, I think. We filmed a couple of programmes in Ireland.
Yeah.
And we started the first... we had the whole mix in there, really, in the two programmes. But we started, and within quite quickly, we had... a fairy believer who had a story about how a motorway had been rerouted because a fairy bush was blocking the construction path. And then we went to a potato festival in the southwest. And oh my goodness, we got, not death threats or anything, but we got some flack on the old social flipping media. And fair dues, I understand, but what I hadn't...
What, because you were portraying the Irish people as a bunch of literally being away with the fairies?
Yeah, a bit of paddywhackery, I think that phrase was used. And I hadn't thought enough about Brits, being a Brit in Ireland. I think it's because I don't feel I am the establishment. You know, I'm not the English person going... I don't feel that baggage, really. But people don't know that. They all think of me as another bloody public schoolboy.
It's quite an interesting repeated line in material about you and, interviews with you, is he didn't come from a background of privilege.
Yeah, that's almost me saying it.
Is it not interesting that there is an assumption that a white guy on TV is going to be that when you came from a sort of solid middle class background in acting? Well, your dad was a maths teacher.
My dad was a maths teacher, but he didn't go to university. Nobody in my family has ever been to university. We were middle class in the sense he'd clawed his way from outside toilet, single family.
Sounds like he was livid quite a lot of the time as well.
Livid?
Yeah.
No, he struggled.
He struggled?
Yeah. He had a tough time, He was a teacher in a difficult period in one of the toughest schools in the country, and he had nothing to fall back on educationally himself. He was an outsider, and he had no father figure himself to pull on, to draw on, to know how to do it. He came from a single parent family. He was an only child. That was hard, and he wasn't great at being a modern dad. He was much more of a 1950s dad, I suppose.
There was a point when one of your teachers said, I know that your father can be difficult.
Yeah, I know it can't be easy, that
sort
of thing.
Yeah.
I feel torn about putting that in. About putting that in print, really, because I feel disloyal, and I love him and I miss him so very desperately, and I mean no ill to him. I think he struggled, but I think all I would try and point out is that the difficulties we had, it's just bloody life. It's just trying. He would have tried to do the right thing and follow the right parental life track, but strayed a bit from it now and again, and it was difficult growing up for me.
Yeah. Thank you. I have to say, it does look very good.
Hello, it's Ollie here. I'm the executive producer on Out to Lunch. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now, one of the relationships I'm proudest of in my life is with my daughters. They're not quite the age to go for fancy lunches with celebs yet, but we do enjoy our family dinners together in relative harmony. You know, give us time, that they are still quite young. But this takes work, and it's a mistake to think that relationships have to be easy to be right. The best relationships come out of learning to live with each other and keeping our sense of humour, even when food is spilt all over the table or dinner's not to everyone's liking. It can be really tricky, but therapy can help you with those skills. You can work through parenting challenges, explore seeing eye to eye as a couple, and work through your relationship with yourself too. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's flexible and you can switch therapists at any time, as that's a relationship that needs to be the right fit too. Become your own soulmate, whether you're looking for one or not. Visit betterhelp.com/outtolunch today and get 10% off your first month.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Are we at the tail end of a pandemic? I think we might be. We all have our stories about the world shutting down around us. Was there a point in the spring of, or the March of 2020, when it dawned on you that the travelling life that you'd been leading was going to stop? And how did you feel about it?
I think it was probably in January 2020 for me, actually, because I'm a sort of cynical, glass half full, negative, pessimist sort of type. I thought it could be over, but I didn't have any idea for how long.
The impression you give in the new book, published on the day that we're talking, Journeys to Impossible Places, is that actually the whole concept of lockdown, of stopping, was for you a bloody nightmare.
Mm. Other people...
I know, other people died in the
they
pandemic.
They really suffered.
And people suffered.
I'm honest
and...
to God, I'm not looking for a second for any sympathy. And I got far too much sympathy from people. Oh, poor Simon, he can't go off on his adventures. I mean, you know, I'm there, I'm a low-level telly presenter, but
we'll accept all of that, but what I am interested in is the person underlying that and how much a part of your fabric, your DNA, the sense of travel was.
But I think what's interesting...
How damaging it was to you.
Yeah, it was really hard, and I think if I can represent in some way a bit the people who need to travel, love to travel, have it in their proper DNA, then all right. It's hard for me, and it was hard for us. I think we've got into this sort of rut almost where we just associate travel with this almost flippant city break, almost that sort of done on a whim. And travel is so much more than that. It is so really at the heart of some people's life experience, and it is really, I think, very much a part of the core of what it is to be a human being for many people, that desire to know what is out there, what is round there. And so I feel that I realized during the first couple of months of the pandemic, my God, I'm really bloody addicted to this. I really need these experiences. Like, you know, you're almost, I suppose, war correspondent adrenaline junkie, frankly. You know that rush of the new experience and the encounter was what I craved and I missed. I did get these sort of weird withdrawal symptoms.
An issue that you've raised many times, and you seem to be becoming more concerned about it, which is that you're no longer just showing exotic places around the world, but displaying the impact we are having upon it.
I think we've always tried to do that, and it's a really hard part of the journey. It's probably one of the toughest, along with leaving people behind, which is probably difficult.
When you say leaving people behind, people who are in poverty or in distressing lives and they're suffering, you've interviewed them, they've been camera fodder, and then you're off.
Yeah, yeah, we've leached off them in some. Yeah, I mean, I beat myself up about that bit, definitely, and then we go.
You've talked about leaving gifts.
Yeah.
Have you ever given money?
Yeah. Definitely. Does that that shouldn't surprise you. We're humans. No, we're traveling in difficult places, but we would never give before. So we would never make it a condition or a lure to talk with us. But I might remember ones where we talked to somebody and they needed an eye operation that would have cost $25 and they couldn't. Those stories like that, of course, afterwards, if you can, if it's appropriate, you take them to one side and you do it in the most respectful way possible. When you're there, when you're still guided, hopefully, by some sort of internal bit of a compass, right, you have to make decisions based on that situation. And yes, we would definitely try and help where possible. But there are times when we absolutely haven't been able to, and times endlessly when we haven't been able to, and we move on, and it's very, very upsetting. But the wider point, to step back from the individuals, because we focus almost in some ways too much on individuals, because that's what makes magazine, newspaper, TV, etc. That's charity appeals. If we step back, then yes, what we have tried to do from the beginning is show the impact that collectively we're having, what we're doing to the planet. Yes, I'm more upset, I'm more worried, I'm more angry, I'm more frightened, actually, and baffled. Because everything I would do is from the standpoint of somebody who loves human beings, and I want us to continue, I want us to survive. I think we're a wonderful species and creature, and I adore us. What the hell are we doing? Why have our systems failed us so much that we are genuinely risking destruction of our entire species as a civilizational creature in this century? I mean, it's much worse than people think. It's much worse than we're being told as well. And that responsibility weighs very heavily on me. Would somebody do it better? I don't know. I think we've done pretty well from the start, but we really try to show the impact, and we try and do it in different ways that keep people engaged. But bloody hell, you know, people have been doing it forever, and still it's COP26 and we're still not sure whether humanity is going to step back.
I want to take it to a back full circle from the perspective of you're now 50.
Nearly, Jay, nearly.
Just about. Oh, yeah, you're right. You're 49. Yeah, I'll give you that. Oh. Simon, you're now 49. If you were in a position to give advice to the 17-year-old Simon Reeve standing on the wrong side of the railings on that bridge over the A40, apart from get back over here, you arsehole, if you wanted to tell him something about how life was going to work out, what would you say?
He'd never have believed it. And it's interesting, I mean, over the years, as I have thought about this, and I've thought, oh, I would say, Simon, it will get better. You'll be okay. I wouldn't have listened. I don't think you can always be so certain that the power of the truth or promise can take somebody back. And I think it's a slightly risky thing to imagine for those of us who are trying to help or deal with somebody who is struggling. Sometimes it has to come from them. They have to say themselves, I need to live, I need to change, I need to do this. And not saying don't love, I'm not saying don't care, but it'll be all right wouldn't have worked on me. What might have worked would have been, rather than don't do it, come on, you apath, step back, would have been, do you want to go for a walk? I think it would have been opportunities, suggestions. I didn't really have those. I didn't have much of an imagination for what was possible. And I think if somebody had perhaps made suggestions that might have worked, had walked a bit of a path with me, but more than anything, just walked any bloody path, frankly, because I really believe there is a power in just one foot after another, just in nature or the streets of West London, wherever the hell you are, just going for a walk. That's what we're designed to do, and it starts to provide answers. So I would say that, really. And I would say to people who are loving someone who's in trouble, don't beat yourself up. You're trying. I think you can apply it to countries, you know. I've been in quite a few countries where you feel the world is shaking them by the shoulders and saying, don't do this. You can do something else. It doesn't have to be like this. Until they tell themselves.
Well, I'd say on that note, I'm going to say, Simon Reeve, thank you for letting me take you out to lunch while you're working your way one piece at a time through your massive steak.
Yeah.
It's been lovely. Thank you.
Thank you, Jay. Thank you so much for having me on.
I really did get to cover a lot of ground with Simon there. His memoir, Journeys to Impossible Places, is available now. Thank you to Gaucho. We visited the outpost near Tower Bridge, but do visit gaucho-restaurants.com as there are a number of locations across the capital and elsewhere in Britain. Naturally, we'd be thrilled if you could share this with everyone you know. Comment, give us, I don't know, 5 stars? Why not? It helps people to discover us. Out to Lunch is a Something Else and Jay Rayner production. The music was written, arranged and performed by me, Jay Rayner, and Robert Rickenberg. The recording and mix engineer was Josh Gibbs. Assistant producers are Anya Das and Bethany Hocken. The producer is Selena Ream, and the executive producer is Darby Doris. Next time, it's comedian and TV presenter Patrick Keelty.
There was one point where a guy came up and said, you know, well, we like that joke, but we're not sure about that. The, you know, the boys aren't sure about that joke.
So, are we talking IRA?
Yeah, we're talking like paramilitaries, or like, you know, going, we're not sure about that one.
Is that the worst review you've ever had?
Probably not.